This is special programming from North State Public Radio. It's been 9 weeks since the campfire started. I'm Mark Albert. Tonight on After Paradise, more uncertainty for fire victims as President Trump announces he's ordered FEMA to cut off aid to California. We ask local politicians how real the threat is. Plus, a look at how the fire damaged water lines in Paradise and what that means for water quality on the ridge. And art plays a role in helping the community recover. We'll hear from local high schoolers and quilters lifting spirits through song and sewing. We want to hear your questions and comments. We've created a new form where you can leave those questions, and you can find it on our website, mynspr.org. For January 10th, 2019, this is After Paradise. The operating word for fire victims this week was confusion. Yesterday, President Trump tweeted that he had ordered FEMA to stop sending money to California, citing, quote, forest mismanagement. That was news to FEMA and to pretty much everyone else. NSPR's Crystal Smith went to the Disaster Recovery Center here in Chico to get reaction from fire survivors.
It was a wet and windy morning outside the former Sears store that now houses FEMA's survivor services. FEMA officials on site wouldn't comment, but many people there reacted to the president's tweet, like Michael Scott of Concow, who lost his home and is still living in a Red Cross shelter.
His timing is way terrible, and he's not doing a great job right now as is. And there are way too many people that need FEMA's assistance right now. And for him to cut it would just be like, I mean, we're all American people, you know, victims of this terrible fire. And for him just to even say that out loud is just terrible.
Other survivors were more measured in their response, like Helen Wheeler, whose father lost his home. She voted for Trump.
Just depends on what's being cut. I think that there is often sometimes overspending, so I would have to know more about it.
Not surprisingly, other evacuees, like Kevin Peek, were more concerned with getting back to their pre-fire lives.
You got to do what you got to do. Just trying to survive. I'm going to get my tools back so I can get back to work.
Trump won Butte County in the 2016 presidential election, but that didn't stop fellow Republicans, State Senator Jim Nielsen and Assemblyman James Gallagher, from calling Trump's threat wholly unacceptable. And they demanded the federal government continue helping survivors of the worst fire in California's history.
That was NSPR's Crystal Smith. California members of Congress were also caught off guard by the president's tweet, among them Congressman Doug LaMalfa, a Republican representing most of the North State.
We do have some very bad forest management practices, just non-management, really. A lot of it is due to the Forest Service being unable or unwilling, whatever it is, over a lot of years to be as aggressive as they are or should be in order to have the type of sustainable forest, you know, tree to acre ratio that it should be, et cetera. So I think this administration is going to move a lot more towards that. We've had Secretary Sonny Perdue from USDA, which oversees Forest Service, out here several trips now in response to the car fire up in Redding and the horrible campfire we have in the Paradise area. So they're aware of that, and I think they really want to ratchet up what it takes to treat these acres. So I share the president's frustration with that.
Right, but I mean, at the same time, the fire victims aren't the ones who impose these restrictions. The fire victims aren't the one making these lawsuits. When the president says, I've ordered FEMA to send no more money, you know, what does that mean? How are you reacting to that?
That side of it, the tweet is not helpful at all, because we don't want our fire victims to think that the effort we've been making is going to come to a stop. So I think the president conflating the two issues into one tweet really missed the mark on that. So I think, you know, in our conversations with the White House so far today and with FEMA, have indicated, like, look, hey, we get it on forest management. We want to help. We'll be a great partner on that. It needs to be done. I've been preaching it for all the years I've been a legislator. But on the need of the people of, you know, the general Paradise area that have been affected by this, you know, the president came up, he visited, he saw that. And he made the commitment, the promise at the time. I believe he'll follow through with it. This tweet will be another tweet in the wind based on whatever his mood was at the time. But going forward, I think he'll keep the commitment. And FEMA today also did another action to extend the period that people can apply for disaster relief on that. So nothing has actually been done to reverse the direction of what FEMA is doing. So no official action on stopping the funding or whatever. Chalk it up to another silly tweet when he was probably angry about Gavin Newsom saying stuff to him. So, you know, I don't know. It isn't helpful, but I think we have enough of a relationship at the White House, as well as my colleague Kevin McCarthy, to basically put this one to bed.
Yeah, obviously, you know, there's a little love lost between the president and California's elected leaders, almost all of whom are from the Democratic Party. But as the guy who represents victims of the Carr and Camp Fire, what are you doing to personally assure that these folks aren't caught up and become victims to a policy dispute between, you know, elected leaders that may have very little to do with?
We're communicating with FEMA and messaging the White House staff and having Kevin McCarthy carry that message to us. Like, you know, let's not do this. Let's not react to something else in this way. And so, I believe that we have a good enough relationship there that they will take that seriously. And no action has been taken. Indeed, FEMA has opened up the door a little bit more to help fire victims with its action today. So, I think this is going to blow over, and we're going to stay on them about that to say, you know, make sure that this doesn't become something. You know, I hope he and Gavin Newsom can settle some differences on some other issues, which I think it's all kind of boiling over on this border situation. And, you know, the president is frustrated with how California doesn't follow federal law. And so maybe he was venting in this fashion here. It's kind of hard to tell.
Well, that's exactly brings me to my next and probably final question here. At least with the wall, the president is very clear. He wants $5.6 billion. In this tweet, he says that you know, unless California gets its act together, what does that mean to get their act together? How do you comply with or, you know, what do you have to do to get your act together in the president's eyes? I mean, you're on the ground with him in Redding on the tarmac there in the wake of the Carr Fire. You're on the ground there in Paradise with him. What's your read?
Well, there's been very good cooperation with the federal and state entities that are actually on the ground up there with FEMA and the California Office of Emergency Services, OES. They're working. They're getting it done. And so, you know, I think as best as humanly possible with the enormous size of this thing, things are going pretty well. So, you know, I mean, it's never fast enough when you're a displaced person there that's, you know, living in a motel or someone else's house or, you know, whether it's a trailer or whatever. But, you know, and I sympathize with that greatly. But, you know, progress is being made. And so as far as California getting their act together, if you're a person with private forest land, you got to go through a heap of paperwork and wasted time to get a timber harvest permit. A lot of people give up because they can't afford all that, and so they don't manage their land, or instead they maybe go develop it. And so I fought that for 8 years as a state legislator. We were able to pass a couple of bills to help a little bit, but we still have a litigious and overly environmental extremism-focused way of doing business in the state of California. So I guess that's where getting this act together and say, look, we need to find the balance between the number of trees per acre that's going to be sustainable and safe versus what we're doing now.
Republican Congressman Doug LaMalfa. Late this afternoon, multiple media outlets reported that the White House has asked the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers to look for money in last year's disaster aid spending bill that could be diverted to pay for a border wall. It was evident at a Paradise Town Council meeting Tuesday that just about everyone wants to get back to normal, but complexity and uncertainty are fraying nerves. The reverence given to elected leaders immediately after the fire now competes with under-breath heckling and isolated demands for a recall election. One of the most vocal points of contention was over the prohibition against living in mobile homes unless a property is more than two-thirds of an acre. Officials said they would reconsider that rule. Another was local contractors and workers feeling shut out of lucrative recovery work. Paradise resident Brad Weldon.
Why are our local contractors who have went and got their hazmat being told they can't clean up their own lots and can't clean up their own places? For one, okay? Wrong. Our local people should be able to work, okay?
Confusion and anger are also complicating debris removal plans, with suspicion growing over the role of subcontractors. Some property owners are reluctant to sign so-called right of entry forms, but without the signatures, the state will not remove debris and homeowners will have to pay for the same services privately, an expensive proposition. Then there's water. Sample results show signs of contamination by a flammable chemical compound used in the production of plastics and gasoline. Mickey Rich, a spokeswoman for the Paradise Irrigation District, spoke at the council meeting.
The district did confirm that the water supply tested positive in some places for benzene.
Tests conducted by both the state and the town showed wide variation. For example, tests of the town reservoir, some pump stations and storage tanks came up clean. Three samples collected at residential water meters likewise contain no benzene. But four samples, mostly from hose bibs outside of homes, did. An engineer with the Division of Drinking Water said the contamination was likely the result of something called pyrolysis. As people desperately fought the inferno, water started running low. That depressurized lines, creating a vacuum that officials believe drew hot air and gases into the water lines. That hot air then deformed and partly melted plastic piping, releasing benzene. Officials aren't sure how widespread the issue is or if flushing the lines will expel the dangerous compound. Mainly, officials said they're on uncharted territory. Other than last year's megafire in Santa Rosa, there's little data. Again, Mickey Rich.
There's enough service lines that are HDPE pipe or plastic pipe that we're going to have to go through much of our system to determine. We're not sure if it's the amount or if it's where they are, right? So you could have two copper and a plastic in the middle of that. And does that cause contamination? We're not sure. We're asking those questions.
Homes built since the mid-1970s may have plastic delivery lines. Earlier construction typically used galvanized steel. Generally, utilities are responsible for water delivery systems up to the water meter, with homeowners liable for the rest. The Del Oro Water District, another utility in the fire zone, said no state-mandated order prohibits customers from drinking the company's water, but notes that if water has an odor of plastic, gasoline, or vinyl, it should not be used for drinking, cooking, or brushing teeth. We talked about the finite patience among fire victims and the larger community in the fire's wake. The outpouring of unequivocal generosity during the disaster continues, but appears more muted with the passage of time. It turns out instant solidarity and sudden camaraderie is quite common in a catastrophe, as are the fissures and disputes that arise as emergencies fade into memory. Laird Easton wrote about this in a recent Washington Post op-ed piece. He's a professor of history at Cal State here in Chico, where he teaches a course on disaster. He came to our studios this week. One of the things that I thought was most interesting or most compelling about your piece in the Washington Post was your discussion of the evolution of the aftermath of crisis and catastrophe, that people immediately have this tremendous solidarity and then that slowly or quickly breaks down over time. Can you elaborate on that?
Yes, you find that often in a catastrophe. A good example would be the 2004 tsunami, where initially people forgot their caste differences, their ethnic differences, and class differences, and came together to help each other, and that's very heartwarming. But ultimately, that dissipates. For one thing, the question of who gets aid emerges, and some people don't, and others do, and that creates tensions. And you find this as well in a catastrophe like the First World War, where initially all the societies came together and felt that they were in this thing together. But over time, class tensions were actually exacerbated by the strain of the war. So this is a common pattern in catastrophes.
That's certainly something that I'm seeing, people kind of being concerned about, you know, who's the worthy poor or the unworthy poor, who's suffered enough to deserve aid or not. And then people initially were giving fire victims the shirts off their back. Last night I was at a Paradise City Council meeting and folks were concerned about the potential damage to property values by allowing modular homes on the streets or throughout town.
Yes, that's a good example, and the concerns about traffic and so forth. On the one hand, one can perhaps console oneself by understanding that this is a common pattern in catastrophes. On the other hand, it's also important to remember to fight against that, to bear this in mind. Inevitably, there's a kind of fatigue that develops after a catastrophe, and so we may be seeing signs of that already. And then there is this very capricious matter of who actually had enough fire insurance, who didn't, and so these issues start to become more salient.
What is the end point, or what's the sort of next piece? Where would this be heading?
A catastrophe of this magnitude, though on a smaller scale than some of the ones I study in my class, takes a very long time to recover from. And there are good examples in history of societies that, in fact, never really recovered from a kind of collapse. So this is a long process. There's going to be, and already are, enormous effects on the housing market. There's a residual population that may not be able to find housing again in California. But this is going to be a very long process.
Laird Easton of Cal State Chico. And this final bit of news, more than 8 million tons of debris has to come down from the ridge before rebuilding can start in Paradise, Magalia, and Concow. The debate over where to put that waste is ongoing, but we now know who will be overseeing the process. It's a company out of Pasadena called Tetra Tech, and it just received the biggest ever single award for wildfire cleanup from Cal Recycles, which was tasked by the governor's office to deal with fire debris. But as reported in today's San Francisco Chronicle, this company is currently being sued by the U.S. Department of Justice for falsifying soil tests at a Bay Area Superfund site. Cal Recycles issued a statement expressing continued confidence in the contractor. You're listening to After Paradise, a special production from North State Public Radio. More just ahead. This is After Paradise, a special program on the aftermath of the campfire from North State Public Radio. I'm Mark Albert. Last November, celebrity chef Guy Fieri of the Food Network show Diners, Drive-Ins, and Dives came to Chico to cook Thanksgiving dinner for evacuees and first responders. After serving some 7,500 pounds of turkey, he went around town and sampled some of the city's dining options. He liked what he saw and tasted so much that this week, he came back to tape an entire episode of his show dedicated to Chico. Reporter Crystal Smith grabbed a few moments with him as he taped a segment at Sin of Cortez.
We shot a special about Chico, a three-restaurant special. So typically a show is made up of three locations, and those locations will be spread throughout the country. But I wanted to do something just about Chico. So three of the locations are going to be grouped together in a Chico special, which never happens. I mean, we very seldom do just one town. But because of the first responders and because of the community and because of all the great things that are going on and all the support that Butte County, Butte Strong, is doing, we thought it'd be fitting to do something about them. So we've got a lot of first responders in the show. We've got a lot of, at the beginning and the end, tell a little bit of the story of what happened. And not so much what happened, but more about the rebuilding and all the positive energy that's going on. And food is a big part of that. You know, we had the fire in Santa Rosa, which was just horrible, and so many of our friends and family had, you know, lost homes and burned close to our house. And fortunately, we didn't lose ours, but we were evacuated, and that was a crazy experience I've never been through. And when that happened, and we watched our own friends and, you know, people that we knew so well, I mean, coaches and people who work at the bank and anybody and everybody, I had an understanding of what was going on and what was needed. And we had fed a bunch of folks there in Santa Rosa when this happened. So when the fires took place up in Redding and Shasta, when the car fire happened, we knew kind of what we could do to help. And that kind of led to knowing what to do to help when we came here for the campfire.
Did you have to evacuate?
Oh, yeah.
What'd you grab?
Grabbed water, grabbed our dogs. We keep all of our photos backed up on hard drives, so we grabbed those out. Grabbed just some simple things, grabbed clothes, you know, not knowing what was going to happen. Probably if there's one, it's very interesting you asked that question. If there's one thing that I would say to everybody is to sit down and now in a time when you're not in stress and so forth, and make yourself a list of what you really should be grabbing. And also maybe make yourself a bug out bag of what things you would need to have with you. Because simple things, like I think we had one phone charger. And everybody, of course, is trying to keep up on what's going on. And we evacuated, I mean, thousands. Our whole street, our whole neighborhood was evacuated. You know, my mom and dad, my wife, my son, our dogs. And so we all evacuated. And so that's one of the things I took from that, is to be the preparedness. And then when we came to the campfire, we were up cooking. We were just in a random parking lot, and we had some really neat community people that helped get us a place to cook. We just went and bought food at Cash and Carry and started cooking. And church groups came, the Salvation Army came, they started giving food. We were buying food at Costco or Cash and Carry, and a gentleman came out and said, "Oh, you're the chef." And I said, "Yeah, what are you making?" He goes, "Well, we're a church group, and we've got a lot of people in our parking lot, a lot of people sleeping in our church, and we're trying to make them some food." I said, "Buddy, I'm here. I'll cook whatever you need. How many people you got?" And he's like, "Seriously? Yeah, come. Here's the address in this random parking lot that I'm at. Come by and get the food." And so just different. Sometimes we'd be making meals for 100. Sometimes we'd be making meals for 500. It's awesome to see when community comes together, and I hate to see that it's in the time of tragedy, you know, when we're going through a really difficult time. But if there's that feeling or that saying or that understanding that if there is a silver lining in such devastation, to see great people rising up, supporting one another. There was no question about politics, no question about this or that. It was just people getting together and getting it done. I saw a lot of love and support and respect. Let's not just wait for when it's a difficult time to have that. You know, we need to have that on a regular basis. And I think that'll solve a lot of the difficult times that our country's facing.
In the aftermath of a disaster, psychologists say that artistic expression can often help victims as they struggle to rebuild their lives. From painting to music, art can bring comfort to people in need. In that vein, students from 5 local high schools, many of them displaced by the fire, have formed a choir that's performing for other affected children. They want to use the power of song to heal their community. Laura Wenis has our story.
You're hearing the voices of more than 120 students from 5 different high schools, captured on tape by other students. They're standing in a protective circle around a group of elementary school kids who are sitting on the floor of a gym. This is the Voices Strong United Choir. A lot of the kids in this choir have had their lives turned upside down. So have the younger kids who are listening, and so have their teachers.
I was teaching on that day.
Sam Gronseth is a music teacher, recently retired from Paradise High School. He was displaced by the campfire and is staying with a friend in Chico. He stepped forward when Dan Labar was looking for someone to lead the project.
Sam knew the educators involved. He brought 5 different high schools together.
Labar is the principal of Inspire School of Arts and Sciences, a charter high school based in Chico.
when the fire hit, Inspire were one of the leading art schools in our region. And so what we know here at our school with the arts and with many schools is that it can be healing and restorative. And there's all sorts of qualities that can bring people together. It's what binds us in many ways with our humanity. And with Paradise, as the days unfolded, it just came to me that we need to be a responder.
They pulled together the choir and its repertoire quickly, at a time when many of the singers weren't able to go to rehearsals.
We actually made tapes, put them online, and the kids latched onto that with the music that they'd sent us, and the kids put it all together because they have the skills to do that.
Grunseth's network picked songs that spoke to what so many of the students and staff had just experienced.
So here are the three songs that we chose. And so Rise Up by Andra Day has some great lines to it about being broken and tired. The encouragement from that is to rise up. You Will Be Found is from Dear Evan Hansen, and the message here is you are not alone. As a matter of fact, there's a place in here where the choir starts singing in unison, you are not alone. And then other parts come in, and other parts come in, and other parts come in. So the thing we began doing is, as we're encircling the kids, going and grabbing the hand of a kid and having them stand in our circle with the choir.
16-year-old Matilda Crolder, a senior at Inspire, lost her home to the fire. She says the performances make students feel understood and heard.
At the first rehearsal, actually, the question was asked, raise your hand if you have lost your home in the fire. And looking around the room and seeing the number of hands raised was pretty impactful. But even though a lot of people had lost their homes or were displaced, they were still singing together. And I think a lot of people need that.
There are still some local students Grunseth says the choir needs to sing for, but he's already looking into the possibility of taking the choir on tour.
I think it's important for us to give these kids who have lost so much opportunities that maybe they wouldn't have normally. I would love to take kids, many in these choirs who have lost their homes, who've lost everything, really, walked away from the fire with the clothes they were wearing, and be able to travel with them and allow them to reflect the struggles that they have had within this whole situation, maybe reflect those to the rest of the community.
As their schools and lives continue to change, the students in the Voices Strong United Choir will continue to sing to each other, showing one another they're not alone. For North State Public Radio, I'm Laura Wenis.
And that's our program for Thursday, January 10th, 2019. We're produced by Sarah Bohannon, Phil Wilkie, and Tess Vigeland. Adam Ragusi composed our theme music. Our engineer is Matt Fidler. And don't forget, we want to hear your questions. Ask anything you want to know about post-campfire recovery at mynspr.org. Thanks for being with us. I'm Mark Albert, and this is After Paradise from North State Public Radio.